This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to reprise one of our favorite guest here on Intelligent Medicine. She always has some really, really incisive insights on the subject of what's the best diet. I mean, that's the perennial question, isn't it? We're bombarded with all kinds of opinions about what constitutes the best diet, from a raw foods vegan diet to macrobiotic diet on one side of the spectrum to a ketogenic, high fat, protein based diet on the other. And today we're going to talk to investigative journalist Nina Teicholz. Nina has written The Big Fat Surprise, Why Better Meat and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. And that's really been a blockbuster of a book. It's been a bestseller. We've talked to her a couple of times in the past. And lately, well, she's been embroiled in controversy. And we'll tell you about it because she is a very, very vociferous critic of the DGA, the Dietary Guidelines for America, which admittedly haven't done such a good job, right, folks? Americans suffering from overweight and diabetes as never before. And we're going to drill down and find out why that is with Nina Teicholz. Nina, it's a pleasure having you back on Intelligent Medicine.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Okay, well, you've been busy, and I've been kind of watching the reports of your controversy. You've unleashed a firestorm. You wrote, or at least participated in an article in what was formerly called the British Medical Journal. Now it's abbreviated just the BMJ, the Big Medical Journal. I guess that's what it is now. It's a very important medical journal, and authored an article in there which was very critical of the Dietary Guidelines for America. So give us some background on that and tell us about the controversy.
Well, this all started in early 2015 when, and for people who don't know, the Dietary Guidelines are the nation's top, most important nutrition policy. And even if you feel like, oh, they don't affect me, I don't go to a .gov website to look about my diet, you know, they really reach out and touch pretty much everybody's lives. Even if you don't think the Dietary Guidelines mean something to you, you don't go to a .gov website to figure out what to eat, the Dietary Guidelines really affects each and every one of us. Sort of the long tentacles of the guidelines touch you in various ways. You know, they control what's in school lunch programs for kids, feeding programs for the elderly. If you have an older parent in a nursing home, their meals are determined by the guidelines.
The military, of course.
The entire military, not only military rations, but what they eat in their mess halls. We have a huge obesity problem and military readiness problem now because of overweight and obesity in the military and diabetes. And they, you know, SNAP programs for the poor, for, they really, one in four Americans eat one of these USDA determined meals each month. And what you, if you go to a doctor or a nutritionist or a dietitian, 99.9% of them are delivering you the information from the guidelines. Mm-hmm. So they really touch every nook and cranny of American life in terms of, you know, recommending what a healthy diet. They're responsible for this idea that, you know, we really should be eating a high grain, mostly fruits and vegetables, very little meat, no butter, very few egg, you know, just mainly grains and fruits and vegetable diet. And because I wrote a book, you know, the central argument of my book was that we had misunderstood saturated fats. We'd gone off the rails and that the science was never strong and could never be proven that saturated fats cause heart disease. And in the years before and since my book was published, I saw like there's an increasing groups of scientists around the world who've gone back and analyzed all the science in saturated fat and come to the same conclusion that I have. Like the science is not there. So there's now like 14 different systematic analyses and meta-analyses or reviews of that science saying saturated fat is not associated with heart disease. It doesn't cause, it has no effect on cardiovascular mortality. So basically saying we got it wrong on saturated fats. So in early 2015, the expert report, which is written by a committee, like 14-person committee for the USDA, they write this expert report for the next iteration of the dietary guidelines. Mm-hmm. They come out once every five years.
And it was really, really disappointing. Tell us about that.
It was disappointing in many, many ways, but one of the ways was that it said the evidence behind the idea that saturated fats causes heart disease remains strong. It remains strong. Mm. And I looked at that and I thought, how is this possible? How is it, you know, I'm reading the science. There's all this science been published now that it's reconsidering saturated fats. What, did they not read the science? So that caused me to take this enormous deep dive into that whole 471-page expert report and really look at it, you know, really page by page, you know, why did they say this and why did they say that? What was their evidence for this and for that? And then, so I wrote up a whole report. It was kind of this self-funded, it was a self-published report. And then out of that, I sent that to the editor-in-chief of the BMJ, and she said, well, this is very interesting. We'd like to commission an article from you based on this report that you wrote. And that turned out to be this hugely contentious article that came out in September of that year. And it made a number of allegations. The central ones were that really the science, that this expert committee had not followed kind of proper scientific procedures for reviewing the science. They were not properly done systematic reviews. There were a number of mistakes in the way they went about them. Just not according to any scientific standard that we know in the field. And so consequently, the guidelines really are not the gold standard that we think they are. And that's super important because, you know, one of the reasons like the American Medical Association, the American Diabetes Association, everybody points back to the guidelines and they say, well, that's because they're the gold standard. They must be that they're the gold standard. So, you know, countries around the world follow us because we're supposed to be the gold standard. So here's an article by a journalist, no less, which was, I guess, an affront to, you know, nutrition experts everywhere. Like, who is she to
right.
say this?
This is it's a medical journal. You have no credentials, and now you're writing about a subject with which you're not qualified. They're unleashed a firestorm.
It did. And, you know, it's one thing to write a book, but it's another thing, as I discovered, to write an article that is peer-reviewed. Once something is peer-reviewed, even though we all know that the process of peer review is enormously flawed and all kinds of things get published that should not be published if proper peer review were done. But once an article is peer reviewed, it has a different kind of stature. It can't really be ignored in the same way that you can ignore a book. Mm-hmm. So after that article came out, there's a normal process after any article comes out, which are these things you write, that people write letters to the editor. In this case, they're called rapid responses and they're posted on the website. And the entire Dietary Guideline Committee wrote one saying, you know, there were all these, alleging all these mistakes.
Mm-hmm. They
were very defensive. And I responded to all of their, allegations. And really, there was one very small kind of, well, it was a correction, but really was very minor and didn't change any of the allegations in the piece. And then it was like, well, that's not enough. This piece cannot be allowed to stand. So
they demanded a retraction. They wanted a retraction.
They demanded a retraction based on supposedly 11 alleged other errors, several of which had already been covered in, you know, earlier by other you know, and other complaints. So then they put the review, the BMJ, this is a lot of pressure coming down on the BMJ, and a lot of pressure on me, I must say. And mm-hmm. So the BMJ did what it typically does in this kind of situation, which is they put it to an outside reviewers. Apparently they asked 5 people to review it, and 3 of them didn't want to touch it.
Yeah.
And 2 of them did. One of them, it turns out, is a contractor for the very office at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services that is responsible for the guidelines. So that was a terrible choice.
Yeah.
But even so, at the end of a sort of tumultuous year of their reviewing my piece, they came out saying, we're not going to retract the piece. The, you know, alleged errors are minor, if any at all. And Fiona Godley, the editor-in-chief of the BMJ, was very strong. She said, you know, we stand by the piece and we stand by its conclusion. And what's more, nutrition science is, well, to paraphrase, a mess. And we really, you know, the field really needs more scrutiny.
Indeed. And we must point out, in your defense, that while you are a non-scientist and known mostly as a journalist, you're not just a writer of diet books, which can be, you know, pretty eccentric. We know from the past history of diet books that are littering the bookstore shelves. But you attended Yale and Stanford, and you were a biology major. So, you know, you have a science background, although you are not a bench scientist. You know, that's not how you make a living these days.
Well, so I did pre-med. I wasn't a biology major. But I did study a lot of biology. But I think really, I think that is even less relevant than the fact that I spent nearly 10 years, well, by the time I wrote this article, 10 years doing nothing but studying nutrition science, mm-hmm. reading every single article that has practically ever been written on the subject of fat, dietary fat, and disease, of which there are thousands. And I really know this field extremely well. And, you know, I think that my knowledge really stands on equal footing with a lot of the experts in the field. And it's a different kind of knowledge, because many people in the field who've come up through the field, they've just sort of taken many pieces of accepted wisdom for granted. Like they assume saturated fats are bad for health. They've never gone back to examine that original science.
Mm-hmm.
They've just taken it, you know, as received wisdom.
It's kind of like the world is flat theory. You know, once you've assumed that the world is flat, you know, all the facts unravel and support that contention until you, you know, fall off the end of the earth.
Right. And the basic tenets of our dietary wisdom, fat is bad for health, saturated fat and cholesterol bad for health, those have been enshrined as pillars of our dietary wisdom for so many mm-hmm. decades that I think people haven't even thought to question them.
And
so now there's sort of a new bunch of us heretics who are challenging this conventional wisdom, and it's a very challenging time in nutrition. I think it's fair to say we're in a moment of tumult in the nutrition world.
And it gets worse, though, because in addition to being challenged in terms of your, you know, the scientific veracity of the article, which is a kind of that's a formal play in the science world. It's like, you know, you write an article, it's challenged, you know, it's kind of a gentlemanly sport, you know, like the Hamilton duel, you know, it's their rules, the game. But there were actually ad hominem attacks launched at you by some individuals. They attacked your integrity. They attacked your person. It got nasty, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I sort of see this from a kind of analytical distance, which is good because, you know, it could be hurtful, but you know, in studying nutrition science, there's a whole section about called the sharp elbows of nutrition science, about the history of bullying, basically, that goes on in the field, these kind of ad hominem attacks, accusing people of being financially motivated by whatever industry they might have had some connection to or been funded by, or with no justification at all, or calling into question somebody's intelligence really underhanded attacks at people whose opinions about the science simply differ from their own. And these traditions in this field of science have been handed down to this current generation. So they think nothing of calling people names. There's a professor, he's not really a professor at Yale, but his center's name is attached to Yale, and he called me an animal to a reporter who reported it in The Guardian, simply because I have different views of science than he does. I was disinvited from a panel of an important food policy conference in Washington, D.C., because the people on the panel, who included a member of the Dietary Guideline Committee and the USDA employee in charge of the guidelines, simply did not want to hear critical views of their science. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a kind of censorship, and you see it happening not just with me. I mean, it would be an honor to be the only one singled out as the threat to all of the nutrition establishment, but there are quite a few people who are such threats around the world, and they have been similarly really censored. You know, there's a professor in South Africa named Tim Noakes, revered scientist who...
Just discussed him with a physician who happens to be of South African background, Dr. Dennis Goodman, and he's all over that case because it's from his country. But tell us about that.
Well, I mention it because I think it's an example of the kind of censorship that is happening for experts who bring up alternative beliefs. So Professor Noakes, who is a revered sports scientist, and really revered around the world, but then he came to the conclusion late in life that he had been wrong to recommend carb loading for distance endurance sports, and that actually a low carb diet was much better. He found this out because he himself was a marathoner who got diabetes, which seemed impossible.
Wow.
So he started recommending a low carb diet. He came out with a book in favor of the low carb diet. He became quite famous for it, and then there was a complaint lodged against him, and he's literally been on trial with the threat of losing his medical license for the last 3 years on the basis of, the accusation is that he's been recommending unconventional advice.
That's like a classic heresy trial from, Galileo on trial,
Scopes trial or something.
Yeah.
I actually went to testify in South Africa for it. Last October, and I went, and my lines of evidence were, this again, why this BMJ article is so important, because it forms part of the evidence. If they're accusing Professor Noakes of not giving the conventional advice because the conventional advice is the so-called gold standard, if you can show that that conventional advice is not the gold standard, it all falls apart. So that's their backstop, is that gold standard that must be right. But in fact, it's not right at all. The evidence for the guidelines is slim to non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've been recommending, the guidelines recommend a high grain, high carbohydrate diet, more than 55% or 50-55% of your calories are supposed to come from carbohydrates, principally grains. So just compare that to Americans in 1965 were eating 39% of their calories as carbohydrates. What happens in 1980 is the dietary guidelines begin. There's a massive uptick in our consumption of carbohydrates, and that's the beginning of the obesity epidemic. So there's now a fairly good body of science showing that it's quite likely our guidelines, our gold standard guidelines, caused the obesity and diabetes epidemics worldwide.
Mm-hmm. And
so that's,
and you probably
yeah,
keep
that's
up
why
with,
I'm a critic.
Well, you probably keep up with the literature. You've looked at hundreds, perhaps thousands of studies that challenge the orthodoxy on this. But just, I believe it was this month, January 2017, there's an article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. It's the Bible of nutrition science, which looks at red meat intake and its relationship to cardiovascular disease. Now, traditionally, virtually every doctor, and they still parrot this advice, they say, reduce your red meat intake. And when I talk to patients, they often kind of guiltily admit, well, occasionally I'll have some red meat, but I'm trying to cut down. In this study, what they found was that more than one half serving per day did not negatively influence cardiovascular disease risk. In fact, more than 3 servings per day, they couldn't find any relationship to cardiovascular disease risk. And yet, as you know, the DASH diet, the Mediterranean diets, recommend precisely that, less than 0.5 servings per day. In other words, maybe 2 to 3 small, you know, palm-sized meat servings per week as a way to optimize cardiovascular risk. So the evidence just keeps rolling in, doesn't it?
Oh, the story of red meat is a particularly complicated one. I mean, red meat has historically been restricted as part of this because it contains saturated fats. The idea was, if you're going to cut saturated fat, you cut cheese, you cut red meat, you cut eggs. Eggs have a little bit of saturated fat in them. And even though, as a starting point, that idea, you know, doesn't make all that much sense because, like, you take your average porterhouse steak, that steak is, a third of that is saturated fat, of the fat in that steak. The other 2/3, are largely oleic acid, which is the kind of, fatty acid you have in olive oil. So all foods are a mixture of unsaturated and saturated fat. So it's not like meat is all saturated fat. But anyway, that was the original rationale for restricting red meat. Now it turns out the whole saturated fat hypothesis is kind of crumbling away. There really is no reason to avoid red meat, but there is culturally quite a bias against red meat that has to do with other factors that have to do with people's disgust for factory farming, mm-hmm. which is
and that's an entirely different thing. That's an entirely different thing.
You know, people. And this new kind of budding idea that cows are a major factor in global warming.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The reason I mentioned that is that those are the reasons that are now being used to reduce your consumption of red meat. They're unrelated to health.
Right.
So, really,
sustainability and you know, protect the environment.
Sustainability.
And so on.
Why not just reduce red meat? You know, and there's this very, very weak data on cancer with the World Health Organization saying red meat causes cancer. That data is so minuscule as to be, I mean, it just doesn't even register really as a.
It may have to do with the type of red meat. I don't think there have been any studies performed on people just consuming red flesh meat or even, you know, organic or grass-fed meat. There's no studies on that subject.
There's no studies to show that lean meat is preferable to regular meat.
Mm-hmm.
There's no studies there's no randomized controlled clinical trials, which is the kind of rigorous evidence that you'd want for policy to show that red meat is bad for health. In fact, in the 2 large government-funded multi-center, multi-year studies in which red meat was reduced as part of a larger multifactorial kind of intervention. So they reduced all foods that were high in saturated fat, and it was like the whole, they basically told people, you know, eat a low-fat diet, which includes reducing meat, and they significantly reduced meat. They saw no improvements for cancer, heart disease, obesity, or diabetes. So that if red meat were a driver of any of those diseases, you should see it, you know, at the end of an 8-year study, right? I mean, if you reduce meat, you should see cancer drop if red meat were a major force mm-hmm. in you know, provoking cancer. But you didn't. There was no difference seen. So there's just no evidence against red meat. And that's why I think that there are these other efforts to kind of find other reasons to avoid red meat. But for health, you know, I think that the advice ought to be the reverse, really. Red meat is the most bioavailable and efficient source of heme iron. You know, anemia is a problem in this country. So things like iron, folate, all the B vitamins in a very calorically efficient way. You get all of that from 100 calories worth of meat, same amount of protein. You don't get, you have to eat 600 calories of peanuts to get that amount of protein. So, you know, red meat is a good source of protein, has a lot, is very dense in vitamins and minerals. So I think red meat ought to be exonerated, but I think it is truly what I call the third rail of nutrition. I mean, mm-hmm. there's just so much controversy around it for mm-hmm. all these other reasons.
All right, we're going to continue our discussion with Nina Teicholz. She's author of The Big Fat Surprise, and she's got a website, thebigfatsurprise.com. Lots of information about her writings, facts about nutrition. You can find them at thebigfatsurprise.com. We're going to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. More on the subject of the food fight. The food fight, something that today's guest has been intimately involved with. We'll share more with you in just a moment. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.